A major legal victory against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers by home and business owners hard hit by Hurricane Harvey. How and what happens next today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Another lawsuit, this time coming in the aftermath of Tropical Storm Imelda, raises questions about how the Houston region is grappling with climate change. We'll explain. Plus, Texas's reputation as the top state for the death penalty may be receding. How new attitudes about capital punishment appear to be leading to big changes. Plus, a somewhat timely PolitiFact check of a claim by Ted Cruz. All that and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 18th day of December 2019. Almost exactly 21 years to the day that the 42nd President of the United States was impeached by the U.S. House of Representatives. The charges against Bill Clinton were perjury and obstruction of justice. In the Senate trial that followed, all 45 Democrats were joined by 5 Republicans not to convict on count 1. 10 Republicans joined the unanimous Democrats on count 2, neither vote coming close to the 67 required to find the president guilty and have him removed from office. Today is likely to go down in history as well. The final outcome also not expected to result in the removal of the president from office. There is likely to be considerable debate in the aftermath. Indeed, it has already started regarding whether the process of impeachment itself is somehow fundamentally flawed. Stay tuned. Another trial, this one an actual legal proceeding, taking place before the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, has concluded with a major victory for home and business owners suing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers over losses incurred during Hurricane Harvey. Joining us now, Gabrielle Banks. She covers federal courts for the Houston Chronicle. Gabby, welcome back to the Standard.
Thank you, David.
Take us back to 2017, Hurricane Harvey. What happened that led to this lawsuit in the first place?
So in the days following the heavy rainfall, water began to accumulate in 2 World War II era dams and reservoirs that are west, about 17 miles west of Houston. And these are built to prevent water in Buffalo Bayou watershed from flooding downtown Houston, which is what happened in the Great Flood of 1938. They were built following that by an act of Congress, and they're meant to retain water in these giant parks, basically. And over the years, over the decades, homes and businesses were built on the back end of those reservoirs. They're basically just parks that extend up and up and up. And that prairie land began to have development in it. And during Harvey, when the water accumulated in those 2 dams, It backed up into those neighborhoods.
I see. Now, we're talking about the areas that became rather well-known as the Attucks and Barker Dam areas. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So what was it that happened that transpired during the course of those downpours? The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers felt it had to make a decision.
So there are 2 sets of lawsuits, and the lawsuit that just came to fruition relates to the people upstream of those 2 dams.
Okay.
And so the decision that they made about releasing water has a much greater impact on the second lawsuit that hasn't happened yet.
All right.
The first lawsuit that's already had a liability decision is related to the upstream people. And whether they open those gates or not, there was still going to be flooding upstream of the dams. A lot of water was detained above those dams.
Well, then what is it that the plaintiffs here were complaining about, that the Army Corps of Engineers built the dams in the first place?
No, they argued successfully that the flooding on their land was preventable and foreseeable, and that the Army Corps should not have allowed water to be detained on their property. They're not saying that it wasn't done for a good reason. The water was detained to prevent catastrophic flooding that would have killed people. They're saying that if the government wants to take their land and borrow it and use it to hold water, that they are owed damages for what happened.
So this is like a takings case, essentially. They're making a claim that the government took this land for the benefit of what? People downstream, maybe for the benefit of preventing more catastrophic damage on down the line, right?
That's correct. And that they knowingly allowed people to build and live in a floodplain. And knowingly doing that, meant that they were going to take people's property in the case of an extreme weather event like they had. And so they said, we have grounds to sue you for the damage to our properties.
So what is it that these victims, these flood victims, homeowners, business owners, are likely to get from the government?
Money. We're talking about 10 to 12,000 properties, and they're going to select a handful of them and put the handful of a variety of different kinds of properties. So it'll probably be a range of different properties in terms of how much damage was done to them. And then the judge will make a decision about how much money people can get.
Thinking about that second lawsuit that you were mentioning, which deals with those who suffered damage living with or had property downstream, is this a kind of barometer or bellwether of sorts for their claims in any way?
I think that the set of issues in that case are different, and I think I'm not in a position to guess what's going to happen, but I do know that they separated the cases for a reason. Because the dams were meant to protect people downstream, and then they did releases, controlled release of water, the set of issues that they're dealing with, meteorological issues and hydrological issues and just damage issues, are going to be different.
It's quite often considered to be pretty hard to try to beat the government in cases like these. What were the government lawyers arguing here, and why weren't their arguments compelling enough?
They did a good job, and they brought strong witnesses, but I think that the plaintiff's lawyers did just a tremendous job of proving their case. And the government argued that this was a once-in-a-lifetime, unprecedented event, and that Hurricane Harvey flooded properties all over the Houston area, having nothing to do with any reservoirs. So why did these properties have special permission to sue the government?
And then the next step will be figuring out how much compensation will be provided by the government, right?
That's right. There's one more thing. This is a cautionary tale about allowing development inside a floodplain. If you look back at the history, there were a series of moments and documents that warned officials that this was coming, that this was dangerous, that this needed to be prevented. And one by one, over decades, decisions were made to allow development to happen. And that came up over and over again in the trial.
Gabrielle Banks reporting for the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Gabby, thanks.
Thank you.
Let's move to another lawsuit related to flood damage. This one from residents in Houston's Kingwood area, hit twice in 2019, once in May, then again in September during Tropical Storm Imelda. Those residents blame the developers of a new residential project nearby for causing more runoff. But the developers say, hey, it's not on them. The storms were just more intense. As Houston Public Media's Jen Rice reports, this lawsuit raises questions about how the expanding Houston area is dealing with new development amid a changing climate.
As it always does, Christmas is coming to Kingwood. But for some residents who've been flooded, it will not be the same.
I don't have any Christmas decorations. I lost everything.
When Nancy Vera's home in Kingwood's Elm Grove subdivision flooded for the first time in May, the family carefully saved all their holiday decorations. But those boxes didn't survive the second storm.
Yeah, that's one of my big heartbreaks.
The first time, she was at work.
And I'm seeing that Kingwood is flooding. My area is flooding. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense. We don't flood.
But they did flood. 2 feet of flood water damaged her home. Vera says her home used to be surrounded by woods. But then, a year ago, she says a developer cleared the trees to make room for the 260-acre residential development that's under construction right next door. Did that cause the flooding? Vera thinks so. But a Montgomery County official I spoke with told me the development didn't cause the flooding. It was the rainfall intensity. I told Nancy Vera what he said.
He's an idiot, because there's trees there, and for 30 years, we never flooded.
She and her neighbors banded together to sue the developer, Perry Holmes, alleging there were violations of the Texas Water Code. In court documents back in May, the first time they flooded, they said, "We're going to flood again," which turned out to be true.
We don't really have time to fool with simple issues like getting runoff right from new developments.
That's Jim Blackburn, a Rice University law professor, who's seen cases like this for decades, where residents blame new development for creating flooding.
That's a problem that simply should not occur. We know enough to keep that from happening, and if it takes litigation to stop it, so be it. I mean, we have strong laws. We should use them.
Suburbs continue to expand around the edges of Harris County, and climate change is producing more intense storms more often. That's why Blackburn thinks the legal arguments in this case matter to many neighborhoods, not just Elm Grove.
Perhaps the more unusual thing is that in this case, it appears that the problem has been discovered in a more timely manner. But there's a long history in Texas of suing over what one neighbor does to another neighbor with regard to flooding.
The Elm Grove case hinges partly on one big question. Was the rainfall in May actually worse than in Hurricane Harvey when the homes didn't flood? Perry Holmes didn't want to talk on tape, but a spokesman told me, yes, rainfall intensity there this year was greater than anything in at least 25 years. But Space City weather meteorologist Eric Berger says official data doesn't show it was worse than Harvey.
It would be really interesting to know the source of the data behind the claims for total rainfall and rainfall intensity that the defendants are basing their defense on. And I think that will be pretty important to deciding the outcome of the case.
Houston City Councilmember Dave Martin knows what outcome he wants, for that land to stay undeveloped.
So what we really need to do is look at our policies and do we continue to build in the floodplains to put people's homes and lives at risk?
Perry Holmes says Montgomery County signed off on their development plan after an engineering firm found that it wouldn't impact nearby homes. That plan includes detention basins to hold water, which are under construction now. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
All right, let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Wednesday. I think I have an idea. Social media editor Wells Dunbar, am I correct?
You would be correct, David. Of course, a historic day in the House of Representatives as they take up impeachment proceedings and a vote against President Donald Trump. On Twitter, the terms Trump impeachment, impeachment day, even Mary impeachmas all trending.
Wow.
On the Texas Standard Facebook page, we have video of the proceedings in the House chamber and several friends and listeners offering their commentary. Matthew Strawn says, based on the evidence, I think impeachment is necessary for obstructing Congress. It's an exercise of equity in the three branches of government. But with Republican control of the Senate, we all know this is going nowhere. Christopher Dromboski echoes that refrain. He says, I already know how this movie ends, so I think I'll skip it. However, Tyler Malloy says, they're watching to see which House members support our country and Constitution, and which ones need to be sent packing. So obviously impeachment, the talk of politics watchers on social media, and heck, on traditional media as well, as you're learning right now.
I'm taking a look at this pretty funny Frank Bruni column. 'Twas the eve of impeachment when all through the House no Republicans wavered, each last one a louse. And it goes on from there, right? You see where... Anyway, it's kind of a little bit of humor anyway. I'm not sure how many Trump supporters are going to find the humor in it. We'd love to know what's making news in your part of Texas. Tweet us right now at Texas Standard. This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. What happens when a mom gets sick and doesn't have childcare lined up during her treatment? That's a critical need often overlooked by researchers studying women's health. But as KERA contributor Sujata Dand reports, Parkland Hospital in Dallas is trying to change that.
What are you doing?
I decorated a tree.
You decorating a tree?
Lakeisha Bunch helps her 3-year-old daughter Baylor put ornaments on their small Christmas tree. Big brother Blake, who's 5, peeks into the living room, smiles, and runs away. Josiah, who's 10 months old, is eager to sit in mommy's lap.
Now, we all joke about how spoiled Josiah is because I was sick. Like, when I'm nauseous and stuff, and I would just lay down. And so I just held him. And so now here he is, still wanting to be held.
Just a few weeks before Josiah was born, Bunch found out that she had breast cancer. A stay-at-home mom, her first thought was, who's going to take care of the children? Lakeisha's husband started taking Fridays off from work whenever he could, so she could get chemotherapy. Family members helped out, too. Still, sometimes she missed appointments or had to bring her children along.
I remember the nurse saying, you have to focus on you. And that's hard. You know, yeah, you know, you do have to focus on you. But I already felt so guilty just about, hold on, baby, felt so guilty about them having to go through all this.
When Bunch scheduled her surgery, a social worker told her about a program called Mommies in Need. The nonprofit provides free full-time nannies for parents who are going through a health crisis. Natalie Boyle founded the organization 5 years ago.
I had six major surgeries. I had thyroid cancer.
Boyle had a series of health problems following the birth of her twins, so she understands how hard it is for mothers to focus on their own health when there's young children at home.
How can you address women's health if you're not taking care of childcare? And nobody had realized that. And I think the only reason I realized it is because I lived it.
Boyle wanted to support more parents dealing with health issues, so she approached Parkland Center for Health Innovation and Clinical Outcomes to create a free daycare on the hospital campus. Parkland was on board, and now the daycare is slated to open next fall. Dr. Kavita Bhavan is the director for Parkland Center for Innovation.
It's going to the front line and thinking about how can we design around people and how can we reimagine how care is delivered.
When experts study barriers to care, they often ask patients about transportation, nutrition, insurance. But no one had considered asking patients about childcare. So Parkland's Dr. Kimberly Coe decided to ask that question and interviewed over 300 mothers at Parkland who had children under the age of 13.
What we found is that when women are asked this question, this is the number one reason that they are missing appointments.
Coe says the study revealed women typically miss 4 appointments a year, and 9 out of 10 said they missed well visits. This may explain why she sees women in the emergency room, especially in the evenings.
They're coming in at like 7 or 8 o'clock. Why is that? It's because their partner has come home from work. They've fed the kids dinner. They've given them a bath. The kids are in PJs now. The husband, whoever, can take care of the kids. And now she can make time for herself. Emergency services cost a lot of money, and it's not the ideal place to get health care.
Lakeisha Bunch gets that, but says sometimes parents just don't have a choice when there's no other reliable childcare. A daycare at the hospital would have meant a lot to her family.
But if I could take them with me and they knew that I'm still in the same place as you, I'm just going to be over here. I know that a lot of my treatments where I would have felt a lot more, I would have felt a lot less stressed.
Doctors involved in this collaboration have high hopes that one day it will stretch beyond the walls of Parkland Hospital, eliminating the need for parents to choose between childcare and their health. I'm Sujatha Dand in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. When we think or talk about mental health issues in veterans, we often refer to post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, but a new study has found that combat exposure commonly leads to grief, and those effects can linger for years after service. For the American Homefront Project, Emily Elena Dugdale has more.
This is just a warm-up.
Jesus Medina hits a black punching bag again and again in the front yard of his home in the Mojave Desert. He spins around and kicks it as his dog Jack barks and runs around by his feet.
Is this one of the things you do in the mornings, too, to kind of manage PTSD and everything?
Okay. To release energy.
Each time he strikes the punching bag, the words tattooed down the length of his forearms move like lightning. On the right, protect. On the left, and serve. Medina is one of about 200 post-9/11 veterans who participated in UC Irvine's study about grief in veterans. 2 days after 9/11, Medina picked up the phone and volunteered for the Army. He landed in Iraq in 2005 and eventually found himself on an elite team of soldiers assigned to take out high-level targets.
Not no thug level, a grenade throwing, pop, pop, pop. No, generals, people that make moves.
That meant a lot of time spent in an armored vehicle that was hit not once, but twice by IEDs.
I'm turning right and boom, and that's when a lot of us got very seriously injured. I woke up in the light and I said, I don't know what's over there, but I need to go back to my family. And all of a sudden it was dark, and then all of a sudden screams, and then all of a sudden hell.
Some of his comrades were seriously wounded in that explosion. As his time in Iraq went on, he saw people die, both Iraqis and his fellow soldiers. Days after he arrived, he was involved in a firefight with insurgents where several lives were lost. Another time, a close friend was shot in the neck. But there weren't a lot of ways to cope with the daily violence. There still aren't.
A lot of us had to do something so inhumane to be able to stay human, which was shut off everything. I mean, I was married at the time, and I stopped calling my wife for almost 2 months.
That didn't come as a surprise to Pauline Lubins, the UC Irvine researcher who interviewed Medina and other veterans about grief.
We think of soldiers, I guess, as these warriors that don't have emotions, but we're dead wrong about that.
While PTSD and depression is well documented in veterans, grief is not.
I think of grief more as a strong emotional response, which we do know has effects on physical health.
The study she co-authored found that post-9/11 veterans who lost fellow service members both to combat and suicide dealt with the losses differently. Combat loss was easier to accept than suicide. And the study also found that combat exposure is almost just as likely to cause grief as it is to lead to PTSD.
One of the veterans said to me, "People are calling me a hero when they don't even know what I did over there. I mean, if I was such a hero, why did I lose so many guys?"
Lubin says mental health professionals need to talk to veterans about grief, and a lot more research is needed to find out if there are effective ways to help troops deal with grief while they're in the service and afterwards. But Jesus Medina isn't optimistic anything will help. He says most veterans he knows are lonely. They don't feel understood.
No matter what, whether you understand grief or not, you have a relationship with it. And if you don't understand it, it really kills you and your family. And when you get to that point, there really is nothing that can fix that burden.
Since coming home, Medina says he's lost 2 fellow veterans to suicide. He says it's because they didn't know what to do with their grief. In Los Angeles, I'm Emily Elena Dugdale.
That story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration reporting on American military life and veterans with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, coming up on 29 minutes past the hour.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A Texas Republican, like many in his party, say Democrats are moving too quickly to impeach President Trump. Congressman Michael Burgess is from Lewisville, north of Dallas. He spoke on the House floor this morning ahead of a vote on 2 articles of impeachment.
Some Democrats have been seeking President Trump's impeachment since his inauguration.
Texans in the U.S. House are largely expected to vote along party lines, with Democrats supporting impeachment and Republicans opposing it. Environment Texas reports illegal air pollution from industrial sites in 2018 was twice as high as the year before. The nonprofit's annual report finds Texas chemical plants, refineries, and oil and gas wells expelled 135 million pounds of unauthorized pollutants last year. The group's Catherine Frazier says despite the increase, enforcement penalties imposed by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality decreased.
We found that only 1% of illegal emissions events actually received enforcement penalties from the TCEQ.
Frazier says the sharp increase in emissions is primarily due to a massive release of carbon dioxide from a Beaumont gasoline plant in August 2018. A local group is distributing funds to victims of the mass shooting at an El Paso Walmart, KERA's Mallory Falk reports.
One Fund El Paso was formed after the August 3rd attack and received more than $11 million in donations from all over the world. Some of that money was distributed quickly to provide immediate support, but the vast majority is being sent out now. Stephanie Carr is coordinator of One Fund El Paso. She says no amount of money can replace the loss or pain families experienced.
But what we hope is that this gift will in some way help ameliorate some of their difficulties and enable them to get their lives put back together in some order.
441 people applied to receive the funds. 363 were approved, including both U.S. and Mexican citizens. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
North Texas County is making clear it welcomes refugees nearly 2 months after President Trump issued an executive order allowing state and local governments to block resettlement. Dallas County Commissioners on Tuesday unanimously passed a resolution which says refugees make cultural and economic contributions to the area. County Judge Clay Jenkins read the measure.
The Dallas County Commissioners Court reaffirms its support of refugees and does hereby consent to the initial resettlement of refugees in Dallas County.
I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The use of the death penalty in Texas continues to decline. This year, 9 Texas inmates were executed by the state compared to 13 last year. Also worth noting, Texas juries last year rejected the use of the death penalty in about half of the capital punishment cases that went to trial. Here to talk with us about capital punishment in Texas and what may be behind some apparent trends here, Kristen Houlet. She is executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. That's an advocacy group. Welcome to the Standard, Kristen.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
What's going on? Are juries' views regarding the death penalty changing, or is there something else at work here?
Well, we've seen a really remarkable decline in the number of new death sentences in Texas. Starting back in around 2005, that's when Texas adopted life in prison without the possibility of parole as a sentencing option in capital cases. And I think that's given both prosecutors and juries much more discretion in how they approach and handle capital murder cases. It's a way of holding those who commit heinous crimes accountable for their actions without resorting to the ultimate and irreversible punishment of the death penalty.
Forgive me for interrupting. I just want to make sure I understand something about this, because there's an interesting dynamic. You hear a lot of people talking about the death penalty these days, and I'm wondering if it is that fewer Texas prosecutors are asking for the death penalty, or if there is a kind of change that is manifesting itself there in the jury room among the jurors.
I think it's both. Certainly, prosecutors in Texas are seeking the death penalty far less often than they used to. Back in 1999, we had 48 new death sentences. For the last 5 years, that number's been in the single digits. And, you know, it is reflective of prosecutors taking far fewer cases to trials, death penalty cases. In fact, we had a dozen cases this year in counties throughout Texas where prosecutors had initially filed their notice of intent to seek death, but then ended up resolving those cases in plea agreements where they took the death penalty off the table or just decided to proceed with a trial without the death penalty. So a lot of this change comes from prosecutors, and we've had a tremendous kind of turnover in prosecutor offices throughout the state. But I think it also we're seeing changes among jurors. They're asked to consider two key questions in the punishment phase of a capital trial where they're seeking the death penalty. The first question is, does the defendant pose a future danger to society? And then the second question is whether there's any mitigating evidence that warrants a sentence other than the death penalty. What we've seen is that with the improvements in legal counsel provided to individuals facing the death penalty, they are able to provide that very critical mitigating evidence that is persuasive to jurors. I think jurors are also increasingly skeptical of this whole future dangerousness question. It's been undermined through research and through really calling into question what that even means and being able to predict future behavior. So I think both of those questions are resulting in different verdicts than we used to see.
See, Kristen, I thought you were going to start to talk a little bit about the high-profile cases of wrongful convictions that we've been reading quite a bit about in recent years. Do you think that that's had any impact?
Yes, I believe that must weigh on the minds of jurors as they consider these cases. So I think they are demanding kind of a higher threshold of evidence and have a higher standard for cases than they might have had in the past.
Well, then let's turn to the post-conviction side of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, what seems to be slowing down executions? Used to be that appeals were often sort of assumed to be, fairly futile. Certainly in the Lone Star State, that was the image that Texas had. What's happening now?
Well, this year, fewer than half of the executions that were scheduled actually were carried out. We had a number of cases that were stayed by state and or federal courts on a range of issues, from actual innocence claims, like we saw in the case of Rodney Reed, mm-hmm. but also some very critical legal challenges related to the use of false testimony, discrimination in the legal proceedings, evidence of intellectual disability, and claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. So I think that we've seen some courts, provide some greater scrutiny of these cases. I should note, though, that there were other cases that raised very similar legal challenges as the cases that were stayed, and in those cases, the courts, decided not to consider the claims, and the executions were allowed to proceed. So I think we still see a very kind of arbitrary system of justice in this state.
Kristen Houlet is executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Kristen, thanks for the update.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
You're tuned to the Texas Standard. Sometime in the 1990s, concerns about rising crime rates in America's urban centers began to focus on Los Angeles as a kind of ground zero. Stories about the Bloods and the Crips and the like often overlooked a more complicated history that preceded events on the West Coast by several decades, though foreshadowing many of the underlying issues of poverty and social isolation. Joining us now is Mike Tapia. He is associate professor in the Department of Criminal Justice at New Mexico State University, and he is the author of the new book, Gangs of the El Paso Juarez Borderland. It's a unique history that reflects diverse subcultures on both sides of the border and the law. Professor Tapia, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
This is your second book about gangs in Texas, as I understand it. What is it about this subject matter? I think the first one had to do with San Antonio, if I'm not mistaken. What is it about this subject matter that draws you in so closely?
It's pure serendipity. I mean, we all kind of follow our life paths and in terms of, how we get into the professions that we do. And it's attributed in part to where I grew up, kind of high poverty area of El Paso's Lower Valley. And in a historic community named Isleta. So I was part of that milieu. That was the environment we grew up in. My buddies in baseball, were also cholos or, gangbangers or whatever. And, it was just kind of part and parcel of the landscape at that point. And then as luck would have it, I guess, upon graduating from university at St. Mary's in San Antonio, as a political science major, no less, so not trained for that type of work. But my first job was just as a gang intervention social worker.
Wow.
So that's how I kind of got my entry to that whole world.
Well, I find that really pretty fascinating considering how much there's a certain, well, you write about this, there's a certain style that is part of the look of gangs, certainly from the 1920s to roughly the 1950s, that is known among people of letters in the humanities as very, very identifiable. I suppose you could call it the Zoot Suit style, maybe. This this made huge ripples across the United States at one point.
Right. It was a really historic period that had a lot to do with, a form of resistance that was manifested in style of dress, kind of street type attitude, street savvy youth from the borderland region. And its origin, is really genuinely here on the El Paso Juarez borderland. It's known as the Pachuco style, right?
Right.
And, you know, in different folks in cultural studies and ethnic studies will attribute it to, you know, offshoots from different region. But I'm convinced, you know, that it is, you know, really genuinely related to the border. And this is where it got its start. And then it was mimicked, you know, in different places. It kind of culturally transferred amongst lower class working boys, Mexican-American boys in the Southwest.
These were the early barrio gangs of El Paso and Juarez, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's, I guess, a good, fair way to put it.
What made them gangs? I mean, there wasn't necessarily a sort of criminological aspect to some of these gangs, right?
That's right. Yeah, and that's why I hesitate, you know, to or qualify it by saying, you know, these were the first gangs, right? I mean, you know, this was really, like I said, kind of a subcultural, you know, resistance of youth of that era, you know, Mexican-American youth or Chicano youth in particular. And yeah, I mean, you know, I guess they kind of they had a bad boy image and stuff like that. So yeah, gangs was, I guess, a much more benign term, and even their form was much different than from what, you know, what we know today, right?
So where did you start to see the element, or when did law enforcement, I suppose, was the first to really identify this as a phenomenology? I mean, when did this start to appear, and why? What were the factors here?
After it transferred, there's a real, you know, lengthy historic migration stream, you know, from El Paso to L.A. And so there's that. This subculture kind of transferred in that current. So I dug up some archives where LAPD detectives assumed, you know, because they were seeing the style in El Paso and LA and all points in between, you know, Phoenix, Tucson, what have you, right? And so they assumed this is a nationwide federation of, of, you know, of bad kids, right, who dress in these zoot suits and stuff. But I mean, you know, it was relatively to today's, you know, kind of crime. And this is just like street corner mischief and, you know, stuff like that. So that's kind of, I think, where it got its, you know, the whole conflict with police and stuff like that.
What is that? Because it wasn't all criminal, of course. This was about ownership. It was about a sense of community, too.
It was, and that's one way that, it's one thing I've really learned about studying this subculture over time, is because that was a big impetus for even, you know, embarking on these projects, just to see how much has this thing really changed. You know, does it in any way resemble that more benign street corner mischievous unsupervised group milling about, you know? And no, it really has changed over time. It's become a lot more insidious. It's become, you know, something tied up in drugs and violence. And so, yeah, it really has morphed over time.
I'm just curious about whether there's a geographical sort of component here, because it's often, you know, people often refer to the sister cities, right? But there's also a competing narrative that you write about as well, and that is the undeniable otherness, too, of Juarez and El Paso.
Yes, it is such a stark contrast between El Paso and Juarez. It's in certain ways, right? And just in terms of the first meets third world contrast, in terms of the poverty and everything on the south of the border, and then, you know, some of the affluence that you see literally right across the border. But yeah, are they sister cities? That's, you know, that's up for debate. That's one of the central themes of the book, because the violence, you know, the gang situation in Juarez is like just of a whole other type than what we're talking about with, you know, the things I've studied in on the Texas side.
What do you think that understanding the gangs of this borderland can teach us about who we are and about how we can live better together, I suppose you could say?
Well, gangs are, whether folks like to believe it or not, a reflection of the community, of some part of the community. You know, it says something about how we're willing to empower our poor or not, or leave those their communities to deteriorate. and where our priorities are as a society in terms of expenditures, public expenditures on education or housing or whatever, to improve certain conditions for poor populations. And so, yeah, gangs, as we all know, just thrive in those contexts. And as long as we as a society are, going to continue to turn a blind eye to that, well, then we've only got ourselves to blame for this social problem called gangs, right?
It's a thought-provoking book that examines gang history in an important region in the United States and certainly in Texas, Gangs of the El Paso-Juarez Borderland. The author is Mike Tapia. He is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at New Mexico State University. Professor, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks, Dave. It was great.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. During a heated exchange with Meet the Press host Chuck Todd on Sunday, a couple of weeks ago, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, the Republican from Texas, repeated a claim that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election on behalf of Democrat Hillary Clinton. But was his claim a fact? Joining us again in the studio, Madeline Meckelberg of PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, good to see you again.
Good to see you too.
All right. So Ted Cruz is not the first person to have raised or repeated this particular claim.
That's right.
In fact, I believe the president himself has
That's the very one.
Put this one out.
Right.
But let's talk about what exactly it was that Cruz said and what the context was. I believe he had been asked a question by Chuck Todd, right?
That's right. So Chuck Todd asked him last week on the show. He had Senator John Kennedy on, and he said a similar claim about Ukraine. And so this week he asked Cruz whether he thought Ukraine interfered in the election. And Cruz says, absolutely, there's considerable evidence of that. And I believe we have audio of their exchange.
Well, let's listen.
Ukraine blatantly interfered in our election.
All right. Well, I suppose that's like just bait for you over at PolitiFact, right? Because what evidence is there?
I love to email to ask for evidence. It's
yes,
my favorite.
I bet you do. So how did you begin to try to fact check this one?
So my first call was to Cruz's office. I asked them if they could offer this supporting information because we've seen a lot of reporting on this subject about how claims related to Ukraine and election interference are not entirely accurate. And Cruz's staff first pointed me to two social media posts that were shared by Ukrainian officials in 2016. Mm-hmm. One was from the Minister of Internal Affairs. He called Trump a clown in his tweet. And the other was from Ukraine's former prime minister. And he was criticizing Trump, who at the time he was the candidate running for office, but when he suggested that the United States may reconsider Russian control of Crimea, and he was criticizing that decision by Trump. And Cruz's office also pointed to two news articles talking about Ukraine. One was from Politico and one was from the Financial Times. Now, we've seen Republicans, including Trump, who have promoted this idea, point to these two articles as the primary evidence for their claim.
Right.
But PolitiFact has looked through these, and they don't say what these officials are saying that they say, if you can follow that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Essentially, they describe an effort by a few officials in Ukraine to discredit Paul Manafort, who at the time was Trump's campaign manager,
right,
by highlighting ties he had to the former Ukrainian government that was friendly with Russia.
He was a lobbyist at the time.
That's right.
Right.
And these two articles, both editors and reporters at these outlets have said that they do not display that there was any kind of top-down effort in Ukraine, an attempt to interfere in the election. It was a few officials, not a coordinated effort, or anything of that sort.
When you say a few officials, not a coordinated effort, I suppose you're referring there to the tweets. I mean, it is somewhat extraordinary for an official in a foreign country to weigh in on the election in another country. I mean, that's not done.
Certainly.
Violates diplomatic protocol, as they might say.
Right. But does that equal election interference?
Well,
that's
the
question.
I think we're about to hear what the answer is to that. was there any other indication? Because I know that certainly if you look at the conversation that followed this particular, this Meet the Press episode, there were a lot of conservatives saying, you see, mainstream media, they just don't want to hear it. They're upset that they didn't get their Russian narrative pushed through, and now they're absolutely refusing to hear anything on possible Ukrainian involvement in the 2016 election, right?
Right. And also the day after Cruz's interview aired, the FBI director had his own interview on ABC News where he was asked about this and this theory that's being promoted.
Right.
And he said that there's no information that the FBI has to indicate that Ukraine interfered in the election. And we've seen intelligence officials, those affiliated with Trump's White House, former White House officials, in the impeachment inquiry hearings that we're having, a separate Senate hearing that was called to specifically investigate whether Ukraine interfered in the election. And they've said time and time again, there's no evidence to support this idea.
All right. So what does PolitiFact Texas have to say about Ted Cruz's claim of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election?
We rated this claim false.
False. That, according to the folks at PolitiFact Texas, Madeline Meckelberg leads them up over at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, good to see you again. Thanks so much. And I guess you'll be back next week.
I'm looking forward to it.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What are you hearing from folks out there today, Wells?
Well, David, probably not a big surprise, but again, impeachment talk, the talk of the nation on social media and really pretty much anywhere else you turn. You know, we asked our friends on Twitter if they were watching the debate and vote, and they appear to be so. In Dallas, our friend Marcel says, absolutely, this is such a rare and historic opportunity. I'll be watching all day. Definitely not alone. You know, I mentioned that we have video on our Facebook page there, facebook.com/Texas Standard, where folks are chiming in. We're having a watch party of sorts. Matthew Strawn describes the Republican opposition that he's seen today, the opposition to impeachment, rather, as a series of deflections, such as it's partisan, the process was flawed, even bringing up President Obama's past actions. Matthew calls that nothing but excuses. Janice Hitchcock also chiming in here about the Republican opposition to impeachment. She says this about another talking point from the president's Republican defenders, that these people complaining about time that could be better spent by Congress doing things like passing bills. Well, Janice says nearly 300 bipartisan bills have gone through the House to die on Mitch McConnell's desk.
That's actually a really an important point to bring up. Not the second part of that comment, which is obviously partisan.
But
in fact, it hasn't stalled a lot of work actually on Capitol Hill. There's been a lot going on. And I mean, witness the move that the House itself took on the same day that they had decided to move forward with impeachment. They went ahead and signed off on that new trade deal.
Yeah, with the Canada USMCA, and Mexico, replacing the North American Free Trade Agreement there in
NAFTA. So, I mean, it's possible to chew gum and walk at the same time, is what
that
I'm saying.
That is what, some people are pointing out. But yeah, there has been a big, I guess, disconnect between a lot of the, you know, stated House priorities and the Senate priorities. It's such in flux, too. You know, it's like, especially with the president, being mercurial, I guess you could say.
Well, he's
what he supports sometime and
letter.
What he does not.
Did you see that letter to
Pelosi? Remarkable letter that the president sent to Nancy Pelosi, sort of written in his trademark, like almost Twitter cadence, I might say.
It didn't seem to be a buffer in terms of the tone there. It was just all the way. Pretty remarkable letter. If you haven't read it, go online, check it out. It's pretty amazing.
Now, definitely one for the history books, and that's what the president's supporters are saying. And the president obviously has the supporters out there. Darren Quigley writes on Facebook that impeachment is such a waste of our taxpayer dollars, all for show by what he calls the do-nothing Democrats. He goes on to say that it will never pass the Senate and predicts that Trump will be here for 4 more years. So obviously there is one partisan prediction, so to speak. So obviously, it's really interesting timing here, too. Obviously, the Christmas season, the holiday season is here.
Yep.
So really some interesting questions about how this is going to play politically for my money. You know, is this sort of just I think some people complain that this is almost being seen as like a check mark that, you know, hey, we impeached the president. Democrats can go back and, you know, bring that to their constituencies.
What do you think? Tweet us or join us on whatever social media platform is your choice. But we'd love to hear from you. At Texas Standard is how you find us on Twitter. Wells Dunbar will be back here tomorrow, so will I. We hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare. The Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.